Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. We engage in the study of the Hebrew Bible in its ancient Near Eastern context and original languages to promote good and reasonable interpretation of Scripture so that the church might live more faithfully in the present. Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Matthew Delaney. I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Nathan French. And today we have a special guest with us. We have Dr. Gary Snitger. And we're very excited to have him on today. He's discussing his new book. We have Torah Story, the second edition, an apprenticeship on the Pentateuch. And Dr. French and I, we've gotten early access to read this book. We've very much enjoyed it. And so we're going to discuss this book. I think it's going to be a great value to people who want to get a better understanding of the Torah. So, Gary, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
My pleasure, Nathan and Matthew. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say Gary is being very generous and is doing a giveaway. So make sure you check out the show notes. We'll put instructions on how you maybe will get a chance to get access to one of Gary's books. So before we dive in, though, in case someone's not familiar with you or your content, can you just introduce a little about yourself, how you got into biblical studies, and specifically, why are you so passionate about the first five books of the Old Testament?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a professor of Old Testament at Cairn University, and so I teach Hebrew, and especially Torah and Prophets is my normal 9 to 5. I don't know how much personal stuff you do, but I think I'm just like everybody else. We all have to put aside when we met our wives and kids as being the best day. But besides that, I used to think that the best day of my adult life was when I bought a snowblower. Because, of course, before that, every time I'm in the driveway shoveling, I think I'm going to have a heart attack. And so what's going through my head is, this is the last thing I'm going to do in my life. My wife's going to come out and find me dead in the driveway with my snow shovel frozen in my hands. But I was wrong. The day I bought my snowblower was not the best day of my life. A few years later, just 2 years ago, we got to move into a condo, and I'm thrilled about it. The best day of my life was when I sold my snowblower. And I couldn't be more helpful at getting that thing in the back of the SUV.
That's great.
It's still my honeymoon period here at the condo, but I love nothing more than watching them shovel the snow. And this year's been a drag because of global warming, of course. But in any case, about the tour.
You know, Gary, I think you win the award for the best podcast intro.
That's so great.
Anyway, about the tour, I think I came to the conclusion a long time ago, early in my teaching, that the whole Bible is Torah-shaped. And so I realized there's really no good way to understand the prophets, wisdom, the Psalms, or the New Testament without really knowing the Torah. So that kind of motivated me to not only how I teach Torah, which was a little bit in contrast back in those days of the first edition of Torah Story, but it made me very excited to be invited all those years ago by Zondervan to write a textbook on the Torah.
Well, really glad that you've done this work. As we said before recording, Nathan and I really enjoyed it. At the end of the episode, I'll give some of my own thoughts on the book, but we've really enjoyed this work. Excited to be talking with you about this.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
So before we, I guess, go into the depths of your book, let's have you give an elevator pitch for your book. What is, just in a nutshell, what is the Torah and why does it matter?
I think one of my burdens is that the gospel of Christ begins with Torah. So the Bible starts, Bereshit, bara Elohim, et hashmayim va'et haaretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the beginning of the gospel. And so for us as Christians, we need to dive deeper than even creation, fall, Calvary, that there's a whole lot more, even in Torah, that unfolds into the gospel. So I'm reading Torah as a Christian, that's for sure. And I think in an elevator, I would assure the person that if they don't know Torah, then there's no way they're really going to know the gospel. There's no way they're going to know the New Testament. And so I think there's other important things besides those two things, but many Christians would agree with the importance of the gospel in the New Testament. And I just think that we're very limited and have a deformed view of Christian life and Christian theology without knowing Torah. That's an elevator pitch or on a tall building.
Yeah, that's great. I think it's so important. And it's very true. We just often forget that from a Christian perspective, these texts really matter because these are the texts that the New Testament Christians are reading, right? This is the very foundation of everything that that they do. So it's really great. I love that you really have that emphasis. You can really tell that within the book. So this question I want to ask here. So what are common misconceptions about how people approach the Torah? Or what is a better way to engage with these important texts?
Well, I think even the name of it, usually people refer to it as the law. So this is a long tradition going back to pre-Christian times in the Septuagint to refer to Torah as law. And especially in Protestant Christianity, this has become a special problem because of the opposition between law and grace. And so that automatically prejudices most Protestant Christians against Torah as though, well, it's not about grace, it's law. And so even stepping back and saying, the word Torah means instruction. We break it down etymologically, it means teaching. So yes, it can be teaching about legal issues, but in Torah, which is a narrative, it's a story, it is especially teaching about redemption and creation and covenant and all of these things that we would value. So I think that that's probably at the core of misconceptions. I think another thing that Christians often will shake their heads and you know, when they're just, I can't believe all these rules that are in Torah. And from my perspective, I want to say, what are you talking about? There's only 613 laws in the Torah. You know, 248 admonitions, one for every part of the human body, 365 prohibitions, one for every day of the year. That's it. In the New Testament, we have over 830 commands, and they're at a much higher level. People are like, well, they're not weird. Well, they're not weird. We were supposed to greet one another with a kiss. I don't live in Europe. I'm sorry. And we're supposed to wear head coverings for if we're females to church. And we're supposed to make sure we pay our ministers enough. Well, because you don't muzzle an ox. And that's what it means. And we're supposed to entertain strangers just in case they happen to be an angelic being. Like, I just don't think that Christians stop and think that the New Testament commands of Christ and his followers, they're at a much higher level. They're very picky. They're very weird. There's a lot of them that we don't obey. And so I think that Christians who kind of shake their head at Torah because of the rules probably are just used to the New Testament. I don't know what to say. So I think that there's, I think, a need for us to not just approach all these things as weird and strange, but to realize that they're just different. I mean, our own culture is very strange as well. I can't even imagine another later culture coming back and looking at the things we watch and do and talk about and thinking about how bizarre we are. So anyway, I just think that there's probably a basic disconnect between many Christians and Torah. And I think it probably begins because they don't know it and they're partially prejudiced against it.
That's good. Yeah.
You know, that's a really helpful perspective because you make me think about when I started learning modern Hebrew. And I remember there was a student who every time Hebrew did something that wasn't the exact way English would do it, her response is, "This is so weird. Why would any language ever do this?"
Right. And we think it's weird.
And our teacher would be quick to say, well, English is weird, right? And give us examples that when you think about it, it doesn't make any sense either.
Right.
So it's a good point that whatever we're most familiar with, we've figured out how to explain away the weirdness. And let's not let weird get in the way, because in reality, these are powerful, beautiful, inspired stories that that are critical for us as Christians.
For sure.
So diving into this idea that the Torah is a story, and I'm going to go ahead and preface, by the way, this interview, we will not at all be able to cover everything in the book.
No.
There is way too much. Yeah. And that's why I'm glad we had some listeners send in some questions, because there's too much to cover here. So one of our listeners had a question about the parallel stories from Exodus through Leviticus to Numbers. And I think this is a good question to start with in terms of like actually looking at the Torah, because you said the Torah is a story, but I think where many people would say that theory breaks down is Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. So you have some interesting graphs and charts and images that kind of help display something interesting going on that I think most people will not see at first glance. Can you maybe walk us through this Exodus through Numbers connection?
Yeah, I think that, this middle part, because Genesis looks back to the beginning, Deuteronomy looks ahead. And so this middle part, these three books, Exodus, we move toward Sinai. So we're in Egypt, we move toward Sinai, we're at Sinai. We stay at Sinai all through Leviticus and in through the first 10 chapters of Numbers. Then we move through the wilderness to the plains of Moab. So a couple of scholars have observed the sort of symmetrical nature of this set. So the late Jacob Milgram, in his commentary on Numbers, he has a really elaborate outline that does a chiastic structure, or what I call mirror imaging, 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1. And he puts Sinai, the revelation at Sinai, in the middle. And so it's sort of framed by this going to Sinai and leaving Sinai. Another scholar, Mark Smith, has been a little bit more particular on Exodus and Numbers as they frame Leviticus. And so he's developed this 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1 format as well. I'm a little bit nonplussed on some of the comparisons he makes, because I don't know what we really get out of comparing Egypt and the plains of Moab. That's gets to be a bit vague. But I think that where there's a real key for us is the first and second generation of Israel in the wilderness. So that in Exodus 15 through 18, let's say, Israel travels and camps in the wilderness. And then in Numbers 10 through 20, Israel travels and camps in the wilderness. And so here we have the travel narratives in Numbers line up with the travel narratives in Exodus. And the camp narrative in Numbers lines up with the camp narrative in Exodus. And so all of that's as it should be, but there's a little bit of a twist in Numbers that makes it really fun. When we read through, we say, wow, these people are in Numbers are just like Exodus, except worse. And we feel like we've been in the wilderness with them sometimes reading for decades, and we see why Moses is ready to scream all the time. Mm-hmm. But the twist comes with, in Numbers 33, there's a long list of the 40 places the people stopped. So not just the three that we know of in the narrative. And along the way, it says that Aaron died in the 40th year. Well, this sort of changes our perspective, because then we go back to Numbers 20, we say, that's where Aaron dies. And we say, oh, this is the second generation? Wow, they sound exactly like their parents, except worse. And so that's kind of a light bulb moment for us, where this comparison helps, because then we have to realize, if the first generation rightfully died in the wilderness, then how can the second generation get out of the wilderness if they're just like their parents, only worse? Yeah. And so kind of this helps us to really evaluate what's going on in Numbers, and to sort of see the grace of God that just pours out upon this very stubborn people, people much like us.
Wow. That's so good. That's so good. Great insights.
Yeah. Love to hear that the God of the Old Testament has grace about him. Yeah. So, so on that note, since we're in Exodus Leviticus, I want to ask this question. So, you know, I always tell my students that Exodus 40 sort of represents like this new Edenic moment in the history of Israel, with Leviticus is that text that says, you know, it gives instruction on how Israel can sustain this marvelous moment of the Lord's presence dwelling again with humanity on the earth. And it was great reading your work. And on page 50, you make this fantastic connection. And you make this quote regarding the tabernacle. And it goes like this, and I quote, the tabernacle is the universe writ small, a microcosm of the creation. You say that on page 50. I mean, it's such good exegesis, one, making these connections, but two, it's just really great theology. So I really love that quote. So could you tell us, what is the significance of the tabernacle in this moment within the larger narrative? And how would readers today benefit from a more advanced understanding like this of the tabernacle in light of Leviticus and its greater function for Israel during its encampment in the wilderness?
Well, that's a really great observation. And I very much, Nathan, sort of share your feeling about this. And I know my students, maybe like yours, dread that part of the semester, but usually that part of the semester, when they look back, that's where they really had some fun. Once we get into Leviticus, yeah, they're like, wow. So I think for the purposes of today, maybe just take a negative positive look at that. Mm-hmm. On the negative side, when the glory of the Lord comes into a tent and he dwells with Israel, this is a very dangerous moment, because here's a God that we've learned has a very, very bad temper. Sometimes he kills everyone, like in Noah's day. And he's also a God that's very particular, and he especially is intolerant towards arrogant, hard-hearted, which means stiff-necked, mm-hmm. kind of people. And so when the glory of the Lord comes into the tabernacle, the people are in great danger. Because it's one thing to be enslaved in Egypt. You can get rid of pharaohs and this sort of oppression with bugs and blood. But what are you going to do about a God like this, who now is dwelling with his people? So it's both a privilege and a danger. Yeah. And I think Exodus 33 captures it well, where the Lord says, listen, I'm not going to go with you. You guys just proved I shouldn't. I was writing a copy of the law, and look what you did. I'm going to send one of my delegates with you. And Moses begs the Lord, no, you send your own glory with us. Mm. And so then that's what happens. The glory of the Lord comes into the tabernacle. But that's where the story of Leviticus then offers just a gift. It begins the narrative this way, something to the effect, and so the Lord called out to Moses from the tabernacle, and he said to Moses, tell the children of Israel this. And practically the whole book of Leviticus is that story. It's the gift of God, instructions so that the people can bear the privilege of God's glory, because they're in great danger. On the positive side, I think that the other thing, and this is something I've thought a lot more about, that plays a role in the second edition of my book that didn't play such a role in the first edition, is when the Lord's glory comes into the tabernacle, Israel is instantly transformed into potential worshipers.
Mm.
What Leviticus is worried about is people need to be ever preparing to enter into the courts of the Lord.
Mm.
It's not just something for the priests. Leviticus 19 pushes further what the Lord said on Mount Sinai. You are a holy kingdom of priests. He says, be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. So this reality of the Lord's glory in the tabernacle just changes life in an instant. So when we think about what Christians can learn, it's tragic that we have Christians today who think that worship can be compressed into part of the day, one day of the week. That's not the way Leviticus looks at it. Leviticus looks at it like, we need to ever be preparing to come into the courts of the Lord. Our lives are dominated by worship. That's who we are. We are potential worshipers of the Lord.
Wow.
So that's maybe a positive side that I've reflected more on in the second edition of this book.
That's really good. That'll preach.
So good. And, yeah.
You know, it's the let your life be a living sacrifice, that New Testament language. But we're just seeing that consistency throughout. This has always been about loving God with all of our heart, with all of our being, you know, with everything that we have. And that's really cool. That's great. Let's do this. Let's ask one more question about the difficult part of the Torah. Because again, we got some, there's something that people think about quite a bit. Is when you say the Torah is a story, I think that many people it still is like, how can it be a story? Because there's just a bunch of laws in there. That's not a story. I wouldn't read a law book. Why, how in the world, this doesn't make any sense. And you already alluded to, we need to kind of change our perspective. The word Torah doesn't mean law inherently. You know, it begins with a bunch of chapters of narrative. So this isn't just a law book. But how do we make sense of the legal sections in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers? How is it that these are truly still stories?
Yeah, I mean, that's really important, and it's something we have to keep coming back to. In Exodus, we have we call it the covenant collection in Exodus 21, 22, and 23. There's also the covenant renewal collection in Exodus 34. Verses 11 to 26. We have the holiness collection in Leviticus, basically chapters 17 through 26. And then the Torah collection in Deuteronomy 12 through 26. So those are just the big collections. Besides that, we of course have the Ten Commandments and a whole bunch of one-off laws. In I think Exodus and Numbers, it's easy to see the dominance of the narrative and the laws are embedded in it. And the story controls. I think probably where we have more challenges in Leviticus and Numbers, which are, you know, these big collections with just a little veneer of story. But on Leviticus, if that's the worst case scenario, there are two stories in the book. In Leviticus 8 through 10, there's a story of the institution of worship. And in chapter 24, there's a story of the blasphemer. One common denominator, at least between these two stories, is people die. And so this kind of goes back to the thesis that I was talking about a few minutes ago of the danger, the grave danger the people are in because Moses has bartered with the Lord and gotten his glory. So though it's a veneer of story, the story of God instructing Moses to tell the people at the head of every chapter it's really important. We don't just have a naked law collection sitting on the table.
That's right.
And it's an illusion for us to just take this naked law collection that we pull out of the Bible. I mean, it comes, even though it's a thin veneer, it hangs its hat on the book of Exodus and the book of Deuteronomy, the book of Numbers. So I think that we do something similar maybe with Deuteronomy, that's a whole different game, but there we're almost entirely listening to Moses. Even the Lord, even the people, everything that's quoted in the whole main first section of Deuteronomy, it comes to us through Moses's recollections. So it's his story of what all these things are doing and whatnot. So yep. I think that it's right, and I don't want to diminish the importance of the legal collections in the Torah. But, you know, I mean, I did put it on the front cover of my book. It's the Torah story is really what's been missing in a lot of Torah scholarship previously.
You know, Nathan has talked before, not take us too left field, but has talked before about there are even law codes of the ancient Near East that when we actually take a look at the whole inscription, they're actually also framed within a narrative. Like the Code of Hammurabi, for example, this is not just here's a bunch of laws, that it's also framed within a narrative. So, you know, Gary, you talk about this, how even if you have a book that the bulk of the content, the word count wise, might have a higher amount of legal material, it's still framed within a narrative. Like Leviticus, for example, begins with a narrative beginning and God spoke to Moses from inside the tent. So really helpful. And what I would encourage anyone is when you get your hands on this book, he really guides you well, you know. the tagline, this is an apprenticeship to the Pentateuch, is very apt. You feel like you have your guide That's there right. with you. And it's really well organized too. To me, it has the best of a textbook and the best of a storybook in one, because it's really well organized. You can jump to any section you want, and there are a lot of great graphs and charts and images that at a glance you can get, you can download a lot of the big picture ideas. But also he speaks like a great storyteller. I mean, you guys heard it with his snowblower. You feel that.
The true story.
Now in a condo.
Yep. This is a very true story.
You feel that in the book too. And I think that's important, because I think it's important that someone who's saying that the Torah is a story, it should feel like a story when you read it, right? Because it could just be, let me give you facts, and you should logically then know it's a story. But as you read Gary's book, it feels like a story as he tells it.
Yeah.
So, you know, any thoughts on this, Nathan?
Well, I love what you're saying with that, because I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. I also love, and that sort of goes into our next question here a bit, the way that you can bring then the critical aspects of the study of the Torah into that, but it doesn't overwhelm it, which can often happen when we dive into the very critical aspects of studying Torah. So you've done a brilliant job of interlacing that within the greater story and the greater understanding of the Torah in this book. So I just thought that was fantastic. Yeah. So I think it's just great for those out there teaching these courses on Torah. This would be a great book to use. Should we ask this listener question, Mati? What do you think?
Yeah. Okay. Let's ask this. So this is by far the most requested listener question that I got from multiple people. One of them asked it specifically this way. How should conservative evangelicals think about the documentary hypothesis? It seems very accepted among some Christian scholars and rejected by others. And I think there are a lot of Christians out there that just don't know what to do with it. And they see people on both sides of the aisle on this issue. So we could do a whole podcast episode on this, but do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah. Let me get at that. I think, I'll try to unpack it just a little bit too, but I think in Torah story, one of the burdens I had back at the time that I wrote the first edition, scholars, academics on both sides of the aisle were dominated by either proving or disproving these documentary theories. There was very little instruction about the Torah going on back in those days. So that was really the burden of Torah story, is not to get into all of these critical theories, but actually study the Torah first, because in my view, that's the priority. Unless we know the Torah, we really can't take steps into navigating critical scholarship. And I think I continue to feel the burden coming into the second edition of not allowing these critical theories to eclipse our first need to study Torah. Yeah. And having said that, I hope that students go through a book like this and study Torah and come to really know it and gain a mastery of it, will go on to more advanced studies. That includes various things, ancient Near Eastern backgrounds, but it also includes engaging the critical scholarship.
Yeah.
And so I think that take this maybe a couple of ways, but one way, when we talk about critical scholarship, it's not just the theory, but the pre-Holocaust European critical scholarship was driven by ideologies. And so the in the atmosphere of older is better, you know, if we think with Wellhausen and his brilliant work on the JEDP, each of those standing for certain competing sources that got pushed together, these contradictory sources in the Pentateuch. But the order is important, JEDP. And so if we stay with J, well, the older is better view, J turns out to be this really great liberal modern European kind of person.
Exactly.
Probably a German. And, you know, Jay, and you can read Wellhausen on this. I'm going to paraphrase. This isn't a quotation. I'm just paraphrasing. But Jay, in the creation story in Genesis 2 through 4, Wellhausen talks about how, you know, there's all the wonder of life and the cool mists in the air and just the miracle of this, of marriage and work and life and beauty. And then Wellhausen turns his attention to P, the last priestly or Jewish part and the Jewish creation story in Genesis 1. And he talks about how it's monotone. There's no mystery. There's no wonder. It's just going through day by day. And the Lord said, bring forth, and then it was. And so really this ideology of finding the earliest part of the Torah created in the image of the scholars who were looking for it, and finding the latest part of the Torah being these Jewish tendencies that practically ruined the Bible with their legalism and their tendencies. It's created after the shape of those folks that these Europeans despised. And so this sort of ideology is really powerful. And so when we look at pre-Holocaust and post-Holocaust critical scholarship, we see a huge difference in what's going on. A big move in post-Holocaust scholarship is to try to rehabilitate, you know, P and put P earlier and this sort of thing. I think a second thing that is really important besides these ideologies is the way truth needs to be treated, or knowledge, in a very unreality sort of a way. That is, because the whole source theory is driven by contradiction, then there needs to be this static view of knowledge. And the expectation is that, you know, the same thing needs to be said with the same words in the same way every time. And any difference, any development is counted as a high contradiction. And it needs to be that way to be able to prove the different sources. And so it's extremely unrealistic to think about a people like Israel being born and living across these very momentous years, going from being slaves to refugees, to wanderers, to invaders, to would-be settlers, and to think that their literature is just going to keep saying the same thing over and over in monochromatic terms. That doesn't even make sense. And so I think there needs to be an allowance for difference without calling it contradiction, development or advancement, without saying, oh, it's not the same word. That's a contradiction. Yeah. And so I think that all of those are very important. And I'm just a word for students. You know, you probably do the same thing. I encourage my students, you know, ground your scholarship in evidence. Follow the evidence. It doesn't matter where it goes. And that's really the thing. Higher critical scholarship, it doesn't use evidence. Otherwise, it wouldn't be higher critical. And so there's, you know, that's viewed as, right, that's not higher criticism. That's based on evidence. And so I'm working my scholarship in an entirely different starting point from these older, higher critical theories. But I think one thing I can say that's maybe practical for your listener's question, there's been some really great work done in evidence in the past few years. And so in Torah Story 2nd edition, I would invite your listener to check out the introductory chapter to Deuteronomy. There I'm highlighting some of the work done by Gordon Johnston, a Hittite scholar, and some of the work done by Sandra Richter in recent years. Both of these scholars have come to very different conclusions than some of the old school thoughts. And their conclusions are grounded in evidence, which makes them very compelling. So those are maybe a scattering of some thoughts that I would tell your listeners, but absolutely go after all of this, but start with Torah first. If we don't know Torah, we don't have any basis for taking any next step.
Wow. Well, thank you for putting so much time and thought into this question, because this is a big one. And I think a lot of people will just skirt around the issue or kind of just avoid. So thank you for giving such a thoughtful response. Things we have really helpful for many people to get to hear, because some may not realize how long of a history the documentary hypothesis has and how many different forms that it takes. But we would just echo what you say, that ultimately goes back to what's the story of the Torah, getting that first, and then addressing some of the other more analytical takes that they kind of have a place. It just matters. We don't get the cart ahead of the horse. And
absolutely. And I think that even the last couple of questions we were talking about, you know, all of the supposed contradictions between the laws, well, they all stem from taking the laws out of the Pentateuch and just dealing with the law codes per se as naked laws. I mean, that's a starting point for discovering these contradictions. But, you know, once we undress the laws, strip the narrative off, and have these naked laws sitting around, it's not really, they don't work that way, because there's a synergy and a contextuality. You know, when we think about the covenant renewal collection in, say, Exodus 34, 11 through 26, that's very contextualized. It doesn't work well to lift it out of its context, even though it's very useful if one were looking for contradictions between it and the other law collections.
Nathan, do you have any thoughts before we move on to our next question?
No, I thought that was very good. I think, when it comes to source criticism, like you said, I mean, it's very fascinating when you get into the discussion and you follow the different arguments and everything that's being said. But you are right. There can be that tendency when you get deep into it, where you find that some scholars are just reading sources and not reading Torah itself, if you will. And on another level, and this is something within source criticism that is, I think, most fascinating, is most source critics don't agree on where divisions are, where they lie. You know, there's often such great disagreement that you follow one and you're like, there it is. I see it. I see the source. And then all of a sudden you've lost it when you go to the next one. Right. So,
So I think I'll add one more point. I think I did a blog piece. I don't know if it's called a blog, but whatever. There's a piece on the web that your listeners can look to. I called it Say You, Say Ye, that handles a little bit of this, maybe taking the next step for some listeners. And I published an article called Going Vertical with Love Thy Neighbor, where I mix it up in a more technical level. That's in JSOT. So those are two places that if a listener is interested in what I actually do and make the next step argument, those are places where I've put a few things out there, a little bit different than what I've just said here, but grounded in evidence kinds of things.
That's great.
Great. Well, we'll link those in the show notes for anyone who wants to follow on that. So another question here is how much closure does the Torah have? Because when we refer to the Torah, we have, okay, a five book, you know, selection. And even though we know, there's more to the story, it's kind of like the Star Wars trilogies. You know, yes, we know that's an ongoing story, but each prequel trilogy each trilogy has a little bit, enough closure, you could say. And sometimes the Torah just doesn't feel that way with Deuteronomy. There are so many plot lines that aren't finished yet. Why does the Torah end where it ends? How do we make sense of whatever closure it has or not?
I think that's a really great observation, and it's probably not just true of the Torah. The same thing would be true of, we call it the Deuteronomistic narrative. Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings has some loose ends. Even Chronicles has some loose ends, and Ezra, Nehemiah has some pretty bad loose ends. So when we think about the Old Testament, we have these loose ends. Same thing with the New Testament. But you're right. I think the Torah, there is closure in a sense of, you know, we have this promise to Abraham, I'm going to give you the land. So there's closure in a sense of the death of Moses, the preparation for entering the land of promise. Just as in the garden, we begin with, before you today, you know, is choice between life and death. Moses says to Israel essentially the same thing. Today, where you stand is a choice between life and death. And I think that Deuteronomy especially is it's a threshold. I mean, we're really between the wilderness and, you know, we can still say it with the same sort of poetic sense, looking across the Jordan at the land of promise. I mean, we're there at that moment. And I think that these, I guess, loose ends or storylines, they get pulled out in the next books. So it is a serial. And so Star Wars might be a good example. So in Joshua, right, building off of the Abrahamic covenant and taking the land, the book of Judges, we might not be in the wilderness, but we feel like we're in the book of Numbers. So here we are in the land of promise, and it's as though it's, you know, it's the same people, but they're degenerating into themselves. The book of Samuel, there's so much there, so I hate to be reductionistic, but, you know, if we think about the high point and the promise that the Lord gives to David, and here we just see a convergence in many ways, but especially of the blossoming of the blessing of Judah and the promises made that one day a Judah king will come and rule forever. And so the specific allusions to the blessing of Judah in the Davidic promise are important. The book of Kings comes back around to worship, building the temple, and what's going to become of this temple that sort of takes over the role of the tabernacle in the hands of these kings, the patrons, and in these two competing kingdoms, the northern and the southern kingdoms of Israel. And then the prophets who preach to these kingdoms, Isaiah especially comes around in the second part of his oracles to a new Exodus and a new creation. Mm-hmm. Jeremiah's one of the high points is a new covenant. Ezekiel with his new temple and the glory and the holiness that dominate his thinking. So I think when we think about the next steps in the Old Testament, you're right in a way that as far as closure, there's closure, but there's definitely some on-ramps that the later narrators and the later prophets take out, but they hardly make sense without Torah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, honestly, it makes it just a great story. We have cliffhangers. There's reason to keep reading. In that way, I guess it's like episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, because, you know, thinking about it, it's, you know, I don't know how much closure that prequel trilogy really gives you. But anyway, I love how you even go through beyond Deuteronomy, the Deuteronomous history. I think we just don't realize how engaging the Bible is. It really is. So I think when people read your book, they're going to feel how engaging a story is. And part of what keeps stories engaging is there's tension. There's actually a plot. There's actually a problem. And there are things that happen along the way, and it makes you want to read the next page. So Your book does a good job helping us to feel that. Okay. Nathan, do you want to ask the next listener question?
Yeah, let's ask this listener question. This is good. So what key ways do later writings use the Torah in the Hebrew Bible and beyond?
Well, that's one of my heartbeat concerns. People that are not familiar with my book, in each chapter, I take a little part at the end. I call it Another Look, I think is what it's called. And most of those are dedicated to, okay, we've just looked at this part of the Torah. How do later biblical authors deal with this? And so there's kind of a little bit of a interaction with that. So that's a running theme through this textbook. And it's also something I've done a lot of work on myself. So it's an area of great interest. I have another book, The Old Testament Use of Old Testament. And if one looks at the chapters on the Pentateuch and there are hundreds and hundreds of places that the Old and the New Testament use Torah. I mean, there's no book of the Bible that's used more by later biblical authors than Torah. So it's really powerful. If we take one example, I'll just go back and think a little bit more specifically to the promise that Nathan gave to David. And so there's a little bit of a wordplay there on house, right? There's the house of David, which is a dynasty, a kingdom, and the house of the Lord, which is a temple. Now, these two houses in this promise to David, they both are grounded in Torah expectations. So the house of David, as I've already said, is grounded on an allusion to the blessing of Judah. And so there's especially where we get to this idea of forever unfolds right out of the promise to Judah and is carried over into the Davidic kingdom. And the in Deuteronomy 12, there's really a central law. We call it centralization, but it's really about when the people get to the land and Israel's decentralized, they need a central place of worship. And so there's allusion to this place legislation, if we want to call it that. There's an allusion to that in Nathan's oracle that really connects with the house of the Lord. And so here you have the house of Yahweh coming out of Deuteronomy 12 and the house of David coming out of Genesis 49. And what brings those together is when the Lord says through Nathan the prophet to David, your son will be my son. So all of a sudden now, the house of David and the house of Yahweh are sort of brought together in this really beautiful way, which sets up really the rest of the Old Testament in so many ways. So one of the major functions of the Davidic kingdom is to be the patrons of the temple and to be the supporter of the sort of worship that Torah called for among Israel.
Wow.
Yeah, that's really good. Making some great connections here all throughout scripture. And that book you wrote, by the way, the Old Testament, Use of the Old Testament, fantastic. In my classes, we just happened to do Joel and Jonah previously, and both of those books use Exodus 34. And so I think people would be surprised how often the Torah is mentioned. And this is important, not just for New Testament studies, but like you said, Old Testament, doing Hebrew Bible study. I think some think about how does the New Testament use the Old Testament? But we forget that the authors of the Hebrew Bible, they're utilizing scripture throughout, and the interconnections are very strong, especially to the Torah.
Yeah. So I think that a funny thing happened. My wife was helping me proofread the second edition of Torah Story, and she had spent a couple of years proofreading Old Testament Use of Old Testament. It's a very long book. And so she said to me one day, we need to talk. I'm thinking, oh, what? So, she didn't have in mind that in first edition of Torah Story, I do all of this, right, these interconnections between Torah and later scriptures. She thought I just lost my mind having written OT Use of OT and dumped all this into the second edition. And I had to actually show her in the first edition. I said, here, look, what you're talking about, it's here. It's in the first edition. This part's not new.
Amazing.
So I think it's important, but I wanted to just qualify that this is part of, I think, what it takes to really be a good apprentice of the scriptures is we read the book, but then we read it again with the prophets and the psalmists and the apostles and Jesus of Nazareth. And so that's what those next steps are to do. They're sort of teasers to get us thinking in a more connected way.
That's good.
Speaking along these lines, I think for many Christians, we get familiar with one-liners in the Hebrew Bible that point to Jesus. Same with the Torah. A simple example is that the descendant of woman will crush the serpent's head. There it is. See, okay, the Torah points to Jesus in that way. But I think what we might not grasp is how does it point to Jesus as a story? And I think, at least for me, that's been a big part of my story, because I think, you know, growing up, I imagine the Old Testament was more like an arid desert wasteland. And there were a few diamonds in the rough, if you will. And we decided we got to leave the diamonds in the desert because it's all holy technically. But man, it's a lot of work. You're going to be really dehydrated and really tired. But every once in a while, you'll run into another one of those diamond verses. And that's the purpose of the Old Testament, is it's a desert sand wasteland that holds diamonds. But then learning about how, no, this is an amazing story. This is all powerful and beautiful, tells the character of God. But with this question I want to ask you is, How is it that the whole story points to Jesus, not just one-liners with the Torah?
Yeah, so the I think that's a really great observation, and I agree with you. I mean, that's something that, you know, we all feel the tension of, because so often the Bible is reduced to creation, fall, and as you said, we can even stop at Genesis 3:15 and then jump to the New Testament. That's it. But now, if we think about the Torah story, I put it in terms of a question. That is, how will the Word of God overcome the human revolution against the Word of God? Mm. So there's a sense of faith in that it Good. Will happen, but that there's a lot of things going on. And so even if we kind of break that down into the books of the Pentateuch, in Genesis, the story's not over. The credits don't roll in chapter 3. That's the beginning of the story. And so there's this really dramatic story that, you know, winds up being about who will be the son with the birthright, who will be the son with the blessing. So the story of the Hebrew ancestors devolves into all this deception. And many people, even reading Genesis, still miss it, because Joseph winds up having this really important role, and he does get the birthright, but he does not get the blessing. That honor goes to Judah. And so seeing this really wonderful story with a double twist ending that runs to Judah, and then I would say Genesis 3:15 is part of this expectation that gets put onto the blessing of Judah. And then we move into Exodus. You know, here we're in the story of the exodus from slavery, the revelation of God, the tabernacle, and the setting for worship. Then again, we're kind of reviewing, but we hit Leviticus. And so the centrality of worship and the idea of a relationship with God and redefining what it means to be God's people. And Numbers is so wonderful. We see how the New Testament, in places like 1 Corinthians chapter 10, will just drill down into this these wilderness stories. And we realize that the problem never was, you know, the Egyptians, the Moabites. The problem never was hunger and thirst. The problem was Israel. And so if there was ever a place that we learn about the need for the gospel, Numbers takes us to the wilderness and schools us in that. Mm. And then Deuteronomy is just this a very powerful moment. I've already used the word threshold, so I don't want to beat a dead horse with that. But where, you know, this is the last day of Moses' life. And so he's piling motivation onto these instructions to help people to put as central to their life to love God and to serve him, and to seek out the fulfillment of God's will. And he even puts this expectation there that I'm not the last prophet, I'm a first prophet. There's going to be other prophets like me who instruct people in God's will. And the book kind of even ends on that very same note with the narrator looking back. Since then, no prophet has risen like Moses. Mm. And so that almost pulls the anticipation. It bounces Deuteronomy forward, if you will. So anyway, I think that we don't have to look for place to stick Jesus in this verse or that verse or some overly clever thing. The story as a whole naturally runs towards its culmination in the teaching, death, and resurrection of the Messiah. So we don't have to like do something to the Bible. We just have to read it.
Yeah, it's so good. I like that. Okay, so as we're closing out here then, on that note, is there anything on your heart that you would want to share with people embarking on the journey of being an apprentice of the Torah, maybe as they begin reading your book?
Yeah, so I mean, if I'm thinking about a student or somebody who's wanting to get started on this, I think that the metaphor that James uses in James 1 is really apt, where he speaks about Torah as a mirror. And I think that so many of us in the modern world, you know, we're with people, especially Christians, who think Torah is a picture. And how often have I been with good church people and they nod their head and say, wow, I'm glad we're not like that. And I hope that the student who's slogging their way through Leviticus and Numbers, I hope that one day, one moment, that Moses reaches up out of the page and grabs the apprentice by the throat and says, this is not a picture. It's a mirror. It's not. Don't you get it?
You are the man. Yeah. No.
And so I hope that there's those moments of clarity that would come to a student.
Wow. That is a powerful note to end on. So now tell us, by the time this recording comes out, your book is out. Tell us, where can people get access to your book and where can they connect more with your content?
I would just, thanks for having me on. Anybody can go to Amazon or wherever they sell books, and Torah Story is what it's called. And I would just say there's two other, besides the textbook, and it's an ebook, and there's all sorts of, at Zondervan Academic, they have a special ebook too. Their special ebook's called Enhanced Edition, and I think they put the videos in it. So there's videos that go with this. Those are available on Amazon Prime and elsewhere. And the second edition, we put a workbook together for it too. So the workbook, I would ask you not to judge the Torah Story workbook by other workbooks you've seen for other textbooks. This was really put through a lot of things, and I got special permission. We test ran the whole thing, not only at my university, but at, Carmen Imes tested it with her students as well. And then we went back and got all this weekly criticism and fixed it up. And so there's all sorts of dynamic things. So the workbook makes it something realistic that even somebody that's, say, not in a classroom, which is probably the best way to do a book like this, somebody could use the workbook and really get something out of it as well through independent study. So
excellent. Well, we'll put links to all of this in the show notes and in the description below. And as I said before, to those of you who are listening to this episode, when it drops, we are doing a giveaway for a few copies of the book. So be sure to see. You'll want to follow us on our social media. Facebook and Instagram is where we'll be doing this giveaway. We have some instructions on what you can do to be able to get that. Very generous of Gary to do that. So Nathan, do you have any thoughts as we close out our episode today?
No, just thank you, Dr. Schnitger, for coming on. It's been a real pleasure to have you. So,
call me Gary, Nathan, Matthew. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. We thoroughly enjoyed the book, and I think a lot of people get great value out of this. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.